This is Kurt Benrud with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our show. We're reading from Thomas Hardy's final novel, Jude the Obscure, first published in 1895. Like much of Hardy's work, this book is quite critical of that era's British society. The novel's divided into six parts, each part into several short chapters. Each part will be read by a pair of readers who alternate chapters. This broadcast is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Part 1 is titled At Mary Green. He begins with a quote from the Book of Esdras. Many there be that have run out of their wits for women, and become servants for their sakes. Many also have perished, have erred, and sinned for women. O ye men, how can it be but women should be strong, seeing they do thus? Brooke North will be reading the odd chapters. Catherine Cabot will be reading the even chapters. Chapter 1.
The schoolmaster was leaving the village, and everybody seemed sorry. The miller at Crescombe lent him the small white tilted cart and horse to carry his goods to the city of his destination, about 20 miles off, such a vehicle proving of quite sufficient size for the departing teacher's effects. For the schoolhouse had been partly furnished by the managers, and the only cumbersome article possessed by the master, in addition to the package case of books, was a cottage piano that he had bought at auction during the year in which he thought of learning the instrumental music. But the enthusiasm having waned, he never acquired any skill in playing, and the purchased article had been a perpetual trouble to him ever since in moving house. The rector had gone away for the day, being a man who disliked the sight of changes. He did not mean to return till evening, when the new schoolteacher would have arrived and settled in, and everything would be smooth again. The blacksmith, the farm bailiff, and the schoolmaster himself were standing in perplexed attitudes in the parlor before the instrument. The master had remarked that even if he got it into the cart, he should not know what to do with it on his arrival at Christminster, the city he was bound for, since he was only going into temporary lodgings just at first. A little boy of 11, who had been thoughtfully assisting in the packing, joined the group of men, and as they rubbed their chins, he spoke up, blushing at the sound of his own voice. "Aunt have got a great fuel house, and it could be put there, perhaps, till you found a place to settle in, sir." "A proper good notion," said the blacksmith. It was decided that a deputation should wait on the boy's aunt, an old maiden resident, and ask her if she would house the piano till Mr. Philiston should send for it. The plaintiff and the bailiff started to see about the practicability of the suggested shelter, and the boys and the schoolmaster were left standing alone. "Sorry I am going, Jude?" asked the latter kindly. Tears rose into the boy's eyes, for he was not among the regular day scholars who came unromantically close to the schoolmaster's life, but one who had attended the night school only during the present teacher's term of office. The regular scholars, if the truth must be told, stood at the present moment afar off, like a certain historic disciples, indisposed to any enthusiastic volunteering of aid. The boy awkwardly opened the book he held in his hand, which Mr. Philiston had bestowed on him as a parting gift, and admitted he was sorry. "So am I," said Mr. Philiston. "Why do you go, sir?" asked the boy. "Ah, that would be a long story. You wouldn't understand my reasons, Jude. You will, perhaps, when you are older."
"I think I should now, sir."
"Well, don't speak of this everywhere. You know what a university is? A university degree? It is the necessary hallmark of a man who wants to do anything in teaching. My scheme, or dream, is to be a university graduate, and then to be ordained. By going to live at Christminster, or near it, I shall be at headquarters, so to speak, and if my scheme is practicable at all, I consider that being on the spot would afford me a better chance of carrying it out than I should have elsewhere." The smith and his companion returned. Old Miss Fawley's fuel house was dry and eminently practicable, and she seemed willing to give the instrument standing room there. It was accordingly left to the school till evening, when more hands would be available for removing it, and the schoolmaster gave a final glance round. The boy Jude assisted in loading some small articles, and at 9 o'clock Mr. Philiston mounted beside his box of books and other impedimenta and bade his friends goodbye.
I shan't forget you, Jude, he said, smiling as the cart moved off. Be a good boy, remember, and be kind to animals and birds, and read all you can. And if ever you come to Christminster, remember, you hunt me out for old acquaintance sake. The cart creaked across the green and disappeared round the corner by the rectory house. The boy returned to the draw well at the edge of the greensward, where he had left his buckets when he went to help his patron and teacher in the unloading. There was a quiver in his lip now, and after opening the well cover to begin lowering the bucket, he paused and leant with his forehead and arms against the framework, his face wearing the fixity of a thoughtful child's who had felt pricks of life somewhat before his time. The well into which he was looking was as ancient as the village itself, and from his present position appeared as a long circular perspective ending in a shining disk of quivering water at a distance of 100 feet down. There was a lining of green moss near the top, and nearer still the hart's tongue fern. He said to himself, in the melodramatic tones of a whimsical boy, that the schoolmaster had drawn at that well scores of times in a morning like this, and would never draw there any more. I've seen him look down into it when he was tired with his drawing, just as I do now, and when he rested a bit before carrying the buckets home. But he was too clever to bide here any longer, a small sleepy place like this. A tear rolled from his eye into the depths of the well. The morning was a little foggy, and the boy's breathing unfurled itself as a thicker fog upon the still and heavy air. His thoughts were interrupted by a sudden outcry. "Bring on that water, will ye, ye idle harlequin?" It came from an old woman who had emerged from her door towards the garden gate from a green-thatched cottage not far off. The boy quickly waved a signal of assent, drew the water with what was a great effort for one of his stature, landed and emptied the big bucket into his own pair of smaller ones, and, pausing a moment for breath, started with them across the patch of clammy greensward whereon the well stood, nearly in the center of the little village, or rather hamlet, of Maygreen. It was as old-fashioned as it was small, and it rested in the lap of an undulating upland adjoining the North Wessex Downs. Old as it was, however, the well shaft was probably the only relic of the local history that remained absolutely unchanged. Many of the thatched and dormered dwelling-houses had been pulled down of late years, and many trees felled on the green. Above all, the original church, humpbacked, wood-turreted, and quaintly hipped, had been taken down and either cracked up into heaps of road metal in the lane or utilized as pigsty walls, garden seats, guard stones to fences and rookeries in the flower beds of the neighborhood. In place of it, a tall new building of modern Gothic design, unfamiliar to English eyes, had been erected on a new piece of ground by a certain obliterator of historic records who had run down from London and back in a day. The site whereon so long had stood the ancient temple of the Christian divinities was not even recorded on the green and level grass plot that had immemorially been the churchyard, the obliterated graves being commemorated by 18-penny cast-iron crosses warranted to last 5 years.
Chapter 2. Slender as was Jude Fawley's frame, he bore the two brimming house buckets of water to the cottage without resting. Over the door was a little rectangular piece of blue board, on which was painted in yellow letters, Drusilla Fawley, Baker. Within the little lead panes of that window, this being one of the few old houses left, were 5 bottles of sweets and 3 buns on a plate of the willow pattern. While emptying the buckets at the back of the house, he could hear an animated conversation in progress within doors between his great-aunt, the Drusilla of the signboard, and some other villagers. Having seen the schoolmaster depart, they were summing up particulars of the event and indulging in predictions of his future. "And who's he?" asked one, comparatively a stranger, when the boy entered. "Well, you might ask it, Mrs. Williams. He's my great-nephew, come since you was last this way." The old inhabitant who answered was a tall, gaunt woman, who spoke tragically on the most trivial subject, and gave a phrase of her conversation to each auditor in turn. "He come from Mellstock, down in South Wessex, about a year ago. Worse luck for him, Belinda," turning to the right. "Where his father was living, and where he took with the shakens for death, and died in 2 days, as you know, Caroline," turning to the left. "It would have been a blessin' if God Almighty had took thee too, with thy mother and father, poor useless boy. But I've got him here to stay with me till I can see what's to be done with him. though I'm obliged to let him earn any penny he can. Just now he's a scaring of birds for Farmer Troutham. It keeps him out of mischief. Why do you turn away, Jude? She continued, as the boy, feeling the impact of their glances like slaps upon his face, moved aside. The local washerwoman replied that it was perhaps a very good plan of Miss or Mrs. Fawley's, as they called her indifferently, to have him with her, to keep ye company in your loneliness, fetch water, shut the window shutters of nights, and help in the bit of bacon. Miss Fawley doubted it. Why didn't ye get the schoolmaster to take ye to Christminster with him, and make a scholar of ye, she continued, in frowning pleasantry. I'm sure he couldn't have took a better one. The boy is crazy for books, that he is. It runs in our family, rather. His cousin Sue is just the same, so I've heard. But I have not seen the child for years, though she was born in this place, within these four walls, as it happened. My niece and her husband, after they were married, didn't get a house of their own for some year or more, and then they only had one until, well, I won't go into that. Jude, my child, don't you ever marry. 'Tisn't for the Fawleys to take that step any more. She, their only one, was like a child of my own, Belinda, till the split come. Ah, that a little maid should know such changes. Jude, finding the general attention again centering on himself, went out to the bakehouse where he ate the cake provided for his breakfast. The end of his spare time had now arrived, and emerging from the garden by getting over the hedge at the back, he pursued a path northward, till he came to a wide and lonely depression in the general level of the upland, which was sown as a cornfield. This vast concave was the scene of his labors for Mr. Troutham the farmer, and he descended into the midst of it. The brown surface of the field went right up towards the sky all around, where it was lost by degrees in the mist that shut out the actual verge and accentuated the solitude. The only marks on the uniformity of the scene were a rick of last year's produce standing in the midst of the arable, the rooks that rose at his approach, and the path athwart the fallow by which he had come, trodden now by he hardly knew whom, though once by many of his own dead family. "How ugly it is here," he murmured. The fresh harrow lines seemed to stretch like the channelings in a piece of new corduroy, lending a meanly utilitarian air to the expanse, taking away its gradations, and depriving it of all history beyond that of the few recent months, though to every clod and stone there really attached associations enough and to spare, echoes of songs from ancient harvest days, of spoken words, and of sturdy deeds. Every inch of ground had been the site, first or last, of energy, gaiety, horseplay, bickerings, weariness. Groups of gleaners had squatted in the sun on every square yard. Love matches that had populated the adjoining hamlet had been made up there between reaping and carrying. Under the hedge which divided the field from a distant plantation, girls had given themselves to lovers who would not turn their heads to look at them by the next harvest. And in that ancient cornfield many a man had made love promises to a woman at whose voice he had trembled by the next seed time, after fulfilling them, in the church adjoining. But this neither Jude nor the rooks around him considered. For them it was a lonely place, possessing, in the one view, only the quality of a work ground, and in the other, that of a granary, good to feed in. The boy stood under the rick before mentioned, and every few seconds used his clacker or rattle briskly. At each clack, the rooks left off pecking, and rose and went away on their leisurely wings, burnished like tassets of mail, afterwards wheeling back and regarding him warily, and descending to feed at a more respectful distance. He sounded the clacker till his arm ached, and at length his heart grew sympathetic with the bird's thwarted desires. They seemed, like himself, to be living in a world which did not want them. Why should he frighten them away? They took more and more the aspect of gentle friends and pensioners, the only friends he could claim as being in the least degree interested in him, for his aunt had often told him that she was not. He ceased his rattling, and they alighted anew. "Poor little dear," said Jude aloud. "You shall have some dinner. You shall. There is enough for us all. Farmer Troutham can afford to let you have some. Eat, then, my dear little birdies, and make a good meal." They stayed and ate inky spots on the nut-brown soil, and Jude enjoyed their appetite. A magic thread of fellow-feeling united his own life with theirs. Puny and sorry as those lives were, they much resembled his own. His clacker he had by this time thrown away from him as being a mean and sordid instrument, offensive both to the birds and to himself as their friend. All at once he became conscious of a smart blow upon his buttocks, followed by a loud clack, which announced to his surprised senses that the clacker had been the instrument of offense used. The birds and Jude started up simultaneously. and the dazed eyes of the latter beheld the farmer in person, the great Troutham himself, his red face glaring down upon Jude's cowering frame, the clacker swinging in his hand. "So it's eat, my dear birdies, is it, young man? Eat, dear birdies, indeed. I'll tickle your britches and see if you say eat, dear birdies, again in a hurry. And if you've been idling at the schoolmaster's, too, instead of coming here, hadn't ye? That's how you earn your sixpence a day for keeping the rooks off my corn." While saluting Jude's ears with this impassioned rhetoric, Troutham had seized his left hand with his own left, and swinging his slim frame around him at arm's length, again struck Jude on the hind parts with the flat side of Jude's own rattle, till the field echoed with the blows, which were delivered once or twice at each revolution. "Don't ye, sir, please don't ye," cried the whirling child, as helpless under the centrifugal tendency of his person as a hooked fish swinging to land, and beholding the hill, the rick, the plantation, the path, and the rooks going round and round him in an amazing circular race.
I, sir, only meant that there was a good crop in the ground. I saw 'em sow it, and the rooks could have a little bit for dinner. And you wouldn't miss it, sir. And Mr. Phillips had said I was to be kind to 'em. Oh!
This truthful explanation seemed to exasperate the farmer even more than if Jude had stoutly denied saying anything at all, and he still smacked the whirling urchin, the clacks of the instrument continuing to resound all across the field and as far as the ears of distant workers, who gathered thereupon that Jude was pursuing his business of clacking with great assiduity, and echoing from the brand-new church tower just behind the midst, toward the building of which structure the farmer had largely subscribed to testify his love for God and man. Presently Troutham grew tired of his punitive task, and depositing the quivering boy on his legs, took a sixpence from his pocket and gave it to him in payment for his day's work, telling him to go home and never let him see him in one of those fields again. Jude leaped out of arm's reach and walked along the trackway weeping, not from the pain, though that was keen enough, not from the perception of the flaw in the terrestrial scheme by which what was good for God's birds was bad for God's gardener, but with the awful sense that he had wholly disgraced himself before he had been a year in the parish, and hence might be a burden to his great aunt for life. With this shadow on his mind, he did not care to show himself in the village, and went homeward by a roundabout track, behind a high hedge and across a pasture. Here he beheld scores of coupled earthworms lying half their length on the surface of the damp ground, as they always did in such weather at that time of the year. It was impossible to advance in regular steps without crushing some of them at each tread. Though Farmer Troutham had just hurt him, he was a boy who could not himself bear to hurt anything. He had never brought home a nest of young birds without lying awake in misery half the night after, and often reinstating them and the nest in their original place the next morning. He could scarcely bear to see trees cut down or lopped, from a fancy that it hurt them, and late pruning, when the sap was up and the tree bled profusely, had been a positive grief to him in his infancy. This weakness of character, as it may be called, suggested that he was the sort of man who was born to ache a good deal before the fall of the curtain upon his unnecessary life should signify that all was well with him again. He carefully picked his way on tiptoe among the earthworms, without killing a single one. On entering the cottage, he found his aunt selling a penny loaf to a little girl, and when the customer was gone, she said, "Well, how do you come to be back here in the middle of the morning like this?" "I'm turned away." "What? Mr. Troutham have turned me away because I let the rooks have a few peckings of corn. And there's my wages, the last I shall ever, hey?" He threw the sixpence tragically on the table. "Ah," said his aunt, suspending her breath. And she opened upon him a lecture on how she would now have him all the spring upon her hands doing nothing. "If you can't scare birds, what can you do? There, don't you look so deedy. Farmer Troutham is not so much better than myself, come to that. But 'tis as Job said, now they that are younger than I have me in derision, whose fathers I would have disdained to have set with the dogs on my flock." His father was my father's journeyman, anyhow, and I must have been a fool to let he go work for him, which I shouldn't have done but to keep he out of mischief. More angry with Jude for demeaning her by coming there than for dereliction of duty, she rated him primarily from that point of view, and only secondarily from a moral one. "Not that you should have let the birds eat what Farmer Troutham planted. Of course you was wrong in that.
Jude, Jude, why didst thou go off with that schoolmaster of thine to Christminster or somewhere? But oh no, poor ordinary child, there never was any sprawl on thy side of the family, and never will be. Where is this beautiful city, aunt, this place where Mr. Phillotson has gone to? Asked the boy, after meditating in silence. Lord, you ought to know where the city of Christminster is. Near a score of miles from here. It is a place much too good for you ever to have much to do with, poor boy, I'm a-thinkin'. And will Mr. Phillotson always be there? How can I tell? Could I go to see him? Lord, no. You didn't grow up hereabout, or you wouldn't ask such as that. We've never had anything to do with folk in Christminster, nor folk in Christminster with we. Jude went out, and feeling more than ever his existence to be an undemanded one, he lay down upon his back on a heap of litter near the pigsty. The fog had by this time become more translucent, and the position of the sun could be seen through it. He pulled his straw hat over his face and peered through the interstices of the plaiting at the white brightness vaguely reflecting. Growing up brought responsibilities, he found. Events did not rhyme quite as he had thought. Nature's logic was too horrid for him to care for. That mercy towards one set of creatures was cruelty towards another sickened his sense of harmony. As you got older and felt yourself to be at the center of your time, and not at a point in its circumference as you had felt when you were little, you were seized with a sort of shuddering, he perceived. All around you there seemed to be something glaring, garish, rattling, and the noises and glares hit upon the little cell called your life and shook it and warped it. If he could only prevent himself growing up, he did not want to be a man. Then, like the natural boy, he forgot his despondency and sprang up. During the remainder of the morning he helped his aunt, and in the afternoon, when there was nothing more to be done, he went into the village. Here he asked a man whereabouts Christminster lay. Christminster? Oh, well, out by there yonder, though I've never been there, not I. I've never had any business at such a place. The man pointed northeastward, in the very direction where lay that field in which Jude had so disgraced himself. There was something unpleasant about the coincidence for the moment, but the fearsomeness of this fact rather increased his curiosity about the city. The farmer had said he was never to be seen in that field again. Yet Christminster lay across it, and the path was a public one. So, stealing out of the hamlet, he descended into the same hollow which had witnessed his punishment in the morning, never swerving an inch from the path, and climbing up the long and tedious ascent on the other side till the track joined the highway by a little clump of trees. Here the plowed land ended, and all before him was bleak, open down.
Chapter 3. Not a soul was visible on the hedgeless highway, or on either side of it, and the white road seemed to ascend and diminish till it joined the sky. At the very top of it was a cross at the right angles by a green ridgeway, the Icknellid Street, an original Roman road through the district. This ancient track ran east and west for many miles, and down almost to within living memory had been used for driving flocks and herds to fairs and markets, but it was now neglected and overgrown. The boy had never before strayed so far north as this from the nestling hamlet in which he had been deposited by the carrier from a railway station southward, one dark evening some few months earlier, and till now he had had no suspicion that such a wide, flat, low-lying country lay so near at hand, under the very verge of his upland world. The whole northern semicircle between east and west, to a distance of 40 or 50 miles, spread itself before him. A bluer, moister atmosphere, evidently, than he breathed up here. Not far from the road stood a weathered, beaten old barn of reddish-gray brick and tile. It was known as the Brown House by people of the locality. He was about to pass it when he perceived a ladder against the eaves, and the reflection that the higher he got, the further he could see, led Jude to stand and regard it. On the slope of the roof, two men were repairing the tiling. He turned into the ridgeway and drew towards the barn. When he had wistfully watched the workmen for some time, he took courage and ascended the ladder till he stood beside them. "Well, my lad, and what may you want up here?" "I wanted to know where the city of Christminster is, if you please." "Christminster is out across there, by that clump. You can see it. At least, you can see it on a clear day." "Ah, no, you can't see it now." The other Tyler, glad of any kind of diversion from the monotony of his labor, had also turned to look towards the quarter designated. "You can't often see it in the weather like this," he said. "The time I've noticed it is when the sun's going down in a blaze of flame, and it looks like, I don't know what."
"The heavenly Jerusalem," suggested the serious urchin.
"Aye, though I should never have thought of that myself. But I can't see no Christminster today."
The boy strained his eyes also, yet neither could he see the far-off city. He descended from the barn, and abandoning Christminster with the versatility of his age, he walked along the ridge track, looking for any natural objects of interest that might lie in the banks thereabout. When he repassed the barn to go back to Maygreen, he observed that the latter was still in its place, but that the men had finished their day's work and gone away. It was waning towards evening. There was still a faint mist, but it had cleared a little, except in the damper tracts of sub-adjacent country and along the river courses. He thought again of Christminster and wished, since he had come 2 or 3 miles from his aunt's house on purpose, that he could have seen for once this attractive city of which he had been told. But even if he waited here, it was hardly likely that the air would clear before night. Yet he was loath to leave the spot, for the northern expanse became lost to view on retreating towards the village only a few hundred yards. He ascended the ladder to have one more look at the point the men had designated, and perched himself on the highest rung, overlying the tiles. He might not be able to come so far as this for many days. Perhaps, if he prayed, the wish to see Christminster might be forwarded. People said that, if you prayed, things sometimes came to you, even though they sometimes did not. He had read in a tract that a man who had begun to build a church and had no money to finish it, knelt down and prayed, and the money came in by the next post. Another man tried the same experiment, and the money did not come. But he found afterwards that the breeches he knelt in were made by a wicked Jew. This was not discouraging, and turning on the ladder, Jude knelt on the third rung, where, resting against those above it, he prayed that the mist might rise. He then seated himself again and waited. In the course of 10 or 15 minutes, the thinning mist dissolved altogether from the northern horizon, as it had already done from elsewhere, and about 1/4 hour before the time of sunset, the westward clouds parted, the sun's position being partly uncovered, and the beams streaming out in visible lines between 2 bars of slaty cloud. The boy immediately looked back in the old direction. Some way within the limits of the stretch of landscape, points of light like topaz gleamed. The air increased in transparency with the lapse of minutes, till the topaz points showed themselves to be vanes, windows, wet roof slates, and other shining spots upon the spires, domes, freestone work, and varied outlines that were faintly revealed. It was Christminster, unquestionably, either directly seen or miraged in the peculiar atmosphere. The spectator gazed on and on till windows and vanes lost their shine, going out almost suddenly like extinguished candles. The vague city became veiled in mist. Turning to the west, he saw that the sun had disappeared. The foreground of the scene had grown funereally dark, and near objects put on hues and shapes of chimeras. He anxiously descended the ladder and started homeward at a run, trying not to think of giants, Hearn the hunter, Apollyon lying in wait for Christian, or of the captain with the bleeding hole in his forehead and the corpses round him that re-mutinied every night on board the bewitched ship. He knew that he had grown out of beliefs in these horrors, yet he was glad when he saw the church tower and the lights in the cottage windows, even though this was not the home of his birth and his great aunt did not care much about him. Inside and round about that old woman's shop window, with its 24 little panes set in lead work, the glass of some of them oxidized with age, so that you could hardly see the poor penny articles exhibited within, and forming part of a stock which a strong man could have carried, Jude had his outer being for some long tideless time, but his dreams were as gigantic as his surroundings were small. Through the solid barrier of cold Cretaceous upland to the northward, he was always beholding a gorgeous city, the fancied place he had likened to the New Jerusalem, though there was perhaps more of the painter's imagination and less of the diamond merchant's in his dreams thereof than in those of the apocalyptic writer, and the city acquired a tangibility,
a permanence, a hold on his life, mainly from the one nucleus of fact that the man for whose knowledge and purpose he had so much reverence was actually living there, not only so, but living among the more thoughtful and mentally shining ones therein. In sad wet seasons, though he knew it must rain at Christminster too, he could hardly believe that it rained so drearily there, whenever he could get away from the confines of the hamlet for an hour or two, which was not often. He would steal off to the brown house on the hill and strain his eyes persistently, sometimes to be rewarded by the sight of a dome or spire, at other times by a little smoke, which, in his estimate, had some of the mysticism of incense. Then the day came when it suddenly occurred to him that if he ascended to the point of view after dark, or possibly went a mile or two further, he would see the night lights of the city. It would be necessary to come back alone, but even that consideration did not deter him, for he could throw a little manliness into his mood, no doubt. The project was duly executed. It was not late when he arrived at the place of outlook, only just after dusk, but a black northeast sky accompanied by a wind from the same quarter made the occasion dark enough. He was rewarded, but what he saw was not the lamps in rows as he half expected. No individual light was visible, only a halo or glow fog overarching the place against the black heavens behind it, making the light and the city seem distant but a mile or so. He set himself to wonder on the exact point in the glow where the schoolmaster might be, he who never communicated with anybody at Maygreen now, who was as if dead to them here. In the glow he seemed to see Phillotson promenading at ease, one of the forms in Nebuchadnezzar's furnace. He had heard that breezes traveled at the rate of 10 miles an hour, and the fact now came into his mind. He parted his lips as he faced the northeast and drew in the wind as if it were a sweet liquor. "You," he said, addressing the breeze caressingly, "were in Christminster City between 1 and 2 hours ago, floating along the streets, pulling round the weathercocks, touching Mr. Phillotson's face, being breathed by him, and now you are here, breathed by me. You, the very same." Suddenly there came along this wind something towards him, a message from the place, from some soul residing there, it seemed. Surely it was the sound of bells, the voice of the city, faint and musical, calling to him. "We are happy here." He had become entirely lost to his bodily situation during this mental leap, and only got back to it by a rough recalling. A few yards below the brow of the hill on which he paused, a team of horses made its appearance, having reached the place by dint of half an hour's serpentine progress from the bottom of the immense declivity. They had a load of coals behind them, a fuel that could only be got to the upland by this particular route. They were accompanied by a carter, a second man, and a boy, who now kicked a large stone behind one of the wheels and allowed the panting animals to have a long rest, while those in charge took a flagon off the load and indulged in a drink round. They were elderly men and had genial voices. Jude addressed them, inquiring if they had come from Christminster.
"Heaven forbid with this load," said they.
"The place I mean is that one yonder." He was getting so romantically attached to Christminster that, like a young lover alluding to his mistress, he felt bashful at mentioning its name again. He pointed to the light in the sky, hardly perceptible to their older eyes.
"Yes, there do seem to be a spot brighter than the northeast than elsewhere, though I shouldn't have noticed it myself, and no doubt it may be Christminster."
Here a little book of tales, which Jude had tucked under his arm, having brought them to read on his way hither before it grew dark, slipped and fell into the road. The carter eyed him when he picked it up and straightened the leaves.
"Ah, young man," he observed, "you'd have to get your head screwed on the other way before you could read what they read up there."
"Why?" asked the boy.
"Oh, they never look at anything that folks like we can understand," the carter continued, by way of passing time. "Only foreign tongues used in the days of the Tower of Babel, when no two families spoke alike. They read that sort of thing as fast as a night hawk will whir. 'Tis all learning there, nothing but learning, except religion. And that's learning, too, for I never could understand it. Yes, 'tis a serious-minded place. Not but there's wenches in the streets o' nights. You know, I suppose they raise parsons there like radishes in a bed. And though it do take, how many years, Bob? 5 years to turn a lurping, hobbledehoy chap into a solemn preaching man with no corrupt passions. They'll do it, if it can be done. and polishing off like the workmen they be, and turning out with a long face and a long black coat and a waistcoat and a religious collar and hat, same as they used to wear in the scriptures, so that his own mother wouldn't know him sometimes. There, 'tis their business like anybody else's. But how should you know? Now don't you interrupt, my boy. Never interrupt your seniors. Move the four hoss aside. Bobby, here some's a-comin'. You must mind that I be a-talkin' in the college life, and lives in a lofty level. There's no gainsaying it, though I myself med not much of them. As we be here in our bodies on this high ground, so be they in their minds. Noble-minded men enough, no doubt, some of them, able to earn hundreds by thinking out loud, and some of them be strong young fellows that can earn almost as much in the silver cups. As for music, there's beautiful music everywhere in Christminster. You med be religious or you med not, but you can't help but striking your homely note to the rest. And there's a street in the place, the Main Street, that ha'n't another like it in the world. I should think I did know a little about Christminster. By this time the horses had recovered breath and bent to their collars again. Jude, throwing a last adoring look at the distant halo, turned and walked beside his remarkably well-informed friend, who had no objection to telling him, as they moved on, more yet of the city, its towers, its halls, its churches. The wagon turned into a crossroad, whereupon Jude thanked the carter warmly for his information, and said he only wished he could talk half as well about Christminster as he.
"Well, 'tis only what has come in my way," said the carter unboastfully. "I've never been there, no more than you, but I've picked up on the knowledge here and there, and you're welcome to it. A-gettin' about in the world, I do, and mixin' with all classes of society. One can't help but hear things. A friend of mine that used to claim the boots at Crozier's Hotel in Christminster when he was in his prime, why, I knowed him as well as my own brother in his later years." Jude continued his walk homeward alone, pondering so deeply that he forgot to feel timid. He suddenly grew older. It had been the yearning of his heart to find something to anchor on, to cling to, for some place which he could call admirable. Should he find that spot in the city if he could get there? Would it be a spot in which, without fear of farmers or hindrance of ridicule, he could watch and wait and set himself some mighty undertaking like the men of old of whom he had heard? As the halo had been to his eyes when gazing at it a quarter of an hour earlier, so was the spot mentally to him as he pursued his dark way. "It is a city of light," he said to himself. "The tree of knowledge grows there," he added a few steps further on. "It is a place that teachers of men spring from and go to. It is what you may call a castle, manned by scholarship and religion." After this figure he was silent a long while, till he added, "It would just suit me."
Chapter 4. Walking somewhat slowly by reason of his concentration, the boy, an ancient man in some phases of thought, much younger than his years in others, was overtaken by a light-footed pedestrian, whom, notwithstanding the gloom, he could perceive to be wearing an extraordinarily tall hat, a swallow-tailed coat, and a watch-chain that danced madly and threw around scintillations of skylight as its owner swung along upon a pair of thin legs and noiseless boots. Jude, beginning to feel lonely, endeavored to keep up with him. "Well, my man, I'm in a hurry, so you'll have to walk pretty fast if you keep alongside of me. Do you know who I am?" "Yes, I think. Physician Vilbert?" "Ah, I'm known everywhere, I see. That comes of being a public benefactor." Vilbert was an itinerant quack doctor, well known to the rustic population, and absolutely unknown to anybody else, as he indeed took care to be, to avoid inconvenient investigations. Cottagers formed his only patients, and his Wessex-wide repute was among them alone. His position was humbler and his field more obscure than those of the quacks with capital and an organized system of advertising. He was, in fact, a survival. The distances he traversed on foot were enormous, and extended nearly the whole length and breadth of Wessex. Jude had one day seen him selling a pot of colored lard to an old woman as a certain cure for a bad leg, the woman arranging to pay a guinea, in installments of a shilling a fortnight, for the precious salve, which, according to the physician, could only be obtained from a particular animal which grazed on Mount Sinai, and was to be captured only at great risk to life and limb. Jude, though he already had his doubts about this gentleman's medicines, felt him to be unquestionably a traveled personage, and one who might be a trustworthy source of information on matters not strictly professional. "I suppose you've been to Christminster, physician?" "I have, many times," replied the long, thin man. "That's one of my centers." "It's a wonderful city for scholarship and religion?" "You'd say so, my boy, if you'd seen it. Why, the very sons of the old women who do the washing of the colleges can talk in Latin. Not good Latin, that I admit, as a critic. Dog Latin, cat Latin, as we used to call it in my undergraduate days. And Greek? Well, that's more for the men who are in training for bishops, that they may be able to read the New Testament in the original. I want to learn Latin and Greek myself." "A lofty desire. You must get a grammar of each tongue." "I mean to go to Christminster some day." "Whenever you do, you say that Physician Vilbert is the only proprietor of those celebrated pills that infallibly cure all disorders of the alimentary system, as well as asthma and shortness of breath. 2 and 3 pence a box, specially licensed by the government stamp. Can you get me the grammars if I promise to say it hereabout? I'll sell you mine with pleasure, those I used as a student." "Oh, thank you, sir," said Jude gratefully, but in gasps, for the amazing speed of the physician's walk kept him in a dog trot, which was giving him a stitch in the side. "I think you'd better drop behind, my young man. Now I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll get you the grammars and give you a first lesson, if you'll remember, at every house in the village, to recommend Physician Vilbert's golden ointment, life drops, and female pills." "Where will you be with the grammars?" "I shall be passing here this day fortnight at precisely this hour of 7:25. My movements are as truly timed as those of the planets in their courses." "Here I'll be to meet you," said Jude. "With orders for my medicines?" "Yes, physician." Jude then dropped behind, waited a few minutes to recover breath, and went home with consciousness of having struck a blow for Christminster. Through the intervening fortnight he ran about and smiled outwardly at his inward thoughts, as if they were people meeting and nodding to him. Smiled with that singularly beautiful irradiation which is seen to spread on young faces at the inception of some glorious idea, as if a supernatural lamp were held inside their transparent natures, giving rise to the flattering fancy that heaven lies about them then. He honestly performed his promise to the man of many cures, in whom he now sincerely believed, walking miles hither and thither among the surrounding hamlets as the physician's agent in advance. On the evening appointed, he stood motionless on the plateau, at the place where he had parted from Vilbert, and there awaited his approach. The road physician was fairly up to time, but to the surprise of Jude on striking into his pace, which the pedestrian did not diminish by a single unit of force, the latter seemed hardly to recognize his young companion, though with the lapse of a fortnight the evenings had grown light. Jude thought it might perhaps be owing to his wearing another hat, and he saluted the physician with dignity. "Well, my boy," said the latter abstractedly. "I've come," said Jude. "You? Who are you?" "Oh, yes, to be sure. Got any orders, lad?" "Yes," and Jude told him the names and addresses of the cottagers who were willing to test the virtues of the world-renowned pills and salve. The quack mentally registered these with great care. "And the Latin and Greek grammars?" Jude's voice trembled with anxiety. "What about them?" "You were to bring me yours, that you used before you took your degree." "Ah, yes, yes, forgot all about it, all. So many lives depending on my attention, you see, my man, that I can't give so much thought as I would like to other things." Jude controlled himself sufficiently long to make sure of the truth, and he repeated in a voice of dry misery, "You haven't brought 'em." "No, but you must get me some more orders from sick people, and I'll bring the grammars next time." Jude dropped behind. He was an unsophisticated boy, but the gift of sudden insight which is sometimes vouchsafed to children showed him all at once what shoddy humanity the quack was made of. There was to be no intellectual light from this source. The leaves dropped from his imaginary crown of laurel. He turned to a gate, leant against it, and cried bitterly. The disappointment was followed by an interval of blankness. He might perhaps have obtained grammars from Alfredston, But to do that required money, and a knowledge of what books to order, and though physically comfortable, he was in such absolute dependence as to be without a farthing of his own. At this date, Mr. Phillotson sent for his pianoforte, and it gave Jude a lead. Why should he not write to the schoolmaster and ask him to be so kind as to get him the grammars in Christminster? He might slip the letter inside the case of the instrument, and it would be sure to reach the desired eyes. Why not ask him to send any old second-hand copies, which would have the charm of being mellowed by the university atmosphere? To tell his aunt of his intention would be to defeat it. It was necessary to act alone. After a further consideration of a few days, he did act, and on the day of the piano's departure, which happened to be his next birthday, clandestinely placed the letter inside the packing case, directed to his much-admired friend, being afraid to reveal the operation to his Aunt Drusilla lest she should discover his motive and compel him to abandon his scheme. The piano was dispatched, and Jude waited days and weeks, calling every morning at the cottage post office before his great-aunt was stirring. At last a packet did indeed arrive at the village, and he saw from the ends of it that it contained two thin books. He took it away into a lonely place and sat down on a felled elm to open it. Ever since his first ecstasy or vision of Christminster and its possibilities, Jude had meditated much and curiously on the probable sort of process that was involved in turning the expressions of one language into those of another. He concluded that a grammar of the required tongue would contain, primarily, a rule, prescription, or clue of the nature of a secret cipher, which, once known, would enable him, by merely applying it, to change at will all words of his own speech into those of the foreign one. His childish idea was, in fact, a pushing to the extremity of mathematical precision, what is everywhere known as Grimm's Law, an aggrandizement of rough rules to ideal completeness. Thus he assumed that the words of the required language were always to be found somewhere latent in the words of the given language, by those who had the art to uncover them, such art being furnished by the books aforesaid. When, therefore, having noted that the packet bore the postmark of Christminster, he cut the string, opened the volumes, and turned to the Latin grammar, which chanced to come uppermost, he could scarcely believe his eyes. The book was an old one, 30 years old, soiled, scribbled wantonly over with a strange name and every variety of enmity to the letterpress, and marked at random with dates 20 years earlier than his own day. But this was not the cause of Jude's amazement. He learnt for the first time that there was no law of transmutation, as in his innocence he had supposed. There was in some degree, but the grammarian did not recognize it. But that every word in both Latin and Greek was to be individually committed to memory at the cost of years of plodding. Jude flung down the books, lay backward along the broad trunk of the elm, and was an utterly miserable boy for the space of a quarter of an hour. As he had often done before, he pulled his hat over his face and watched the sun peering insidiously at him through the interstices of the straw. This was Latin and Greek, then. Was it this grand illusion? The charm he had supposed in store for him was really a labor like that of Israel and Egypt. What brains they must have in Christminster and the great schools, he presently thought, to learn words one by one up to tens of thousands. There were no brains in his head equal to this business, and as the little sun rays continued to stream in through his hat at him, he wished he had never seen a book, that he might never see another, that he had never been born. Somebody might have come along that way who would have asked him his trouble, and he might have cheered him by saying that his notions were further advanced than those of his grammarian. But nobody did come, because nobody does. And under the crushing recognition of his gigantic error, Jude continued to wish himself out of the world.
Chapter 5. During the 3 or 4 succeeding years, a quaint and singular vehicle might have been discerned moving along the lanes and byroads near Maygreen, driven in a quaint and singular way. In the course of a month or two after the receipt of the books, Jude had grown callous to the shabby trick played on him by dead languages. In fact, his disappointment at the nature of those tongues had, after a while, been the means of still further glorifying the erudition of Christminster. To acquire languages, departed or living, in spite of such obstinacies as he now knew them inherently to possess, was a Herculean performance which gradually led him on to a greater interest in it than in the presupposed patent process. The mountain weight of material under which the ideas lay in those dusty volumes, called the classics, piqued him into a dogged, mouse-like subtlety of attempt to move it piecemeal. He had endeavored to make his presence tolerable to his crusty maiden aunt by assisting her to the best of his ability, and the business of the little cottage bakery had grown in consequence. An aged horse with a hanging head had been purchased for £8 at a sale. A creaking cart with a witty brown tilt obtained for a few pounds more, and this turnout became Jude's business thrice a week to carry loaves of bread to the villagers and solitary cotters immediately round Maygreen. The singularity aforesaid lay, after all, less in the conveyance itself than in Jude's manner of conducting it along its route. Its interior was the scene of most of Jude's education by private study. As soon as his horse had learnt the road and the houses at which he was to pause a while, the boy, seated in front, would slip the reins over his arm, ingeniously fix open, by means of a strap attached to the tilt, the volume he was reading, spread the dictionary on his knees, and plunge into the simpler passages from Caesar, Virgil, or Horace, as the case might be, in his purblind, stumbling way, and with an expenditure of labor that would have made a tender-hearted pedagogue shed tears, yet somehow getting at the meaning of what he read and divining, rather than beholding, the spirit of the original, which often to his mind was something else than that which he was taught to look for. The only copies he had been able to lay hands on were old Delphin editions, because they were superseded, and therefore cheap. But, bad for idle schoolboys, it did so happen that they were passably good for him. The hampered and lonely itinerant conscientiously covered up the marginal readings and used them merely on points of construction, as he would have used a comrade or a tutor who should have happened to be passing by. And though Jude may have had little chance of becoming a scholar by these rough and ready means, he was in the way getting into the groove he wished to follow. While he was busied with these ancient passages, which had already been thumbed by hands, possibly in the grave, digging out thoughts of these minds so remote, yet so near, the bony old horse pursued his rounds, and Jude would be aroused from the woes of Dido by the stoppage of his cart and the voice of some old woman crying, "Two today, baker, and I return the stale one." He was frequently met in the lanes by pedestrians and others without his seeing them, and by degrees the people of the neighborhood began to talk about his method of combining work and play, such as they considered his reading to be, which, though probably convenient enough to himself, was not altogether a safe proceeding for other travelers along the same roads. There were murmurs. Then a private resident of an adjoining place informed the local policeman that the baker's boy should not be allowed to read while driving, and insisted that it was the constable's duty to catch him in the act, and take him to the police court at Alfredston, and get him fined for dangerous practices on the highways. The policeman thereupon lay in wait for Jude, and one day accosted and cautioned him. As Jude had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to heat the oven, and mix and set the bread that he'd be distributed later in the day, he was obliged to go to bed at night immediately after laying the sponge, so that if he could not read his classics on the highways, he could hardly study at all. The only thing to be done was, therefore, to keep a sharp eye ahead and around him as well as he could in the circumstances, and slip away his books as soon as anybody loomed in the distance, the policeman in particular. To do that official justice, he did not put himself much in the way of Jude's bread cart, considering that in such a lonely district the chief danger was to Jude himself, and often on seeing the white tilt over the hedges, he would move away in another direction. On a day when Fawley was getting quite advanced, being now about 16, and had been stumbling through Carmen Seculare on his way home, he found himself to be passing over the high edge of the plateau by the brown house. The light had changed it, and it was the sense of this which caused him to look up. The sun was going down, and the full moon was rising simultaneously behind the woods, in the opposite quarter. His mind had become so impregnated with the poem that, in a moment of the same impulsive emotion which years before had caused him to kneel on the ladder, he stopped the horse, alighted, glanced round to see that nobody was in sight, knelt down on the roadside bank with open book. He turned first to the shiny goddess, who seemed to look so softly and so critically at his doings, then to the disappearing luminary on the other hand, as he began, "Phoebe silverumque potens Diana." The horse stood still till he had finished the hymn, which Jude repeated under the sway of a polytheistic fancy that he would never have thought of humoring in broad daylight. Reaching home, he mused over his curious superstition, innate or acquired, in doing this, and the strange forgetfulness which had led to such a lapse from common sense and custom in one who wished, next to being a scholar, to be a Christian divine. It had all come of the reading of heathen works exclusively. The more he thought of it, the more convinced he was of his inconstancy. He began to wonder whether he could be reading quite the right books for his object in life. Certainly there seemed a little harmony between this pagan literature and the medieval colleges at Christminster, that ecclesiastical romance in stone. Ultimately, he decided that in his sheer love of reading he had taken up a wrong emotion for a Christian young man. He had dabbled in Clark's Homer, but had never yet worked much at the New Testament in the Greek, though he possessed a copy, obtained by post from a second-hand bookseller. He abandoned the now familiar Ionic for a new dialect, and for a long time onward limited his reading almost entirely to the Gospels and Epistles in Griesbach text. Moreover, on going into Alfredston one day, he was introduced to patristic literature by finding at the bookseller's some volumes of the Fathers which had been left behind by an insolvent clergyman of the neighborhood. As another outcome of this change of groove, he visited on Sundays all the churches within a walk, and deciphered the Latin inscriptions on 15th-century brasses and tombs. On one of these pilgrimages, he met with a hunchback old woman of great intelligence who read everything she could lay her hands on, and she told him more yet of the romantic charms of the city light and lore. Thither he resolved as firmly as ever to go. But how live in that city? At present he had no income at all. He had no trade or calling of any dignity or stability whatever in which he could subsist while carrying out an intellectual labor which he might spread over many years. What was most required by its citizens? Food, clothing, and shelter. An income from any work in preparing the first would be too meager. For making the second, he felt a distaste. The preparation of the third requisite he inclined to do. They built in a city. Therefore he would learn to build. He thought of his unknown uncle, his cousin Susanna's father, an ecclesiastical worker in metal. And somehow, medieval art in any material was a trade for which he had rather a fancy. He could not go far wrong in following his uncle's footsteps and engaging himself a while with the carcasses that contained the scholar souls. As a preliminary, he obtained some blocks of free stone, metal not being available, and suspending his studies a while, occupied his spare half-hours in copying the heads and capitals in his parish church. There was a stonemason of a humble kind in Alfredston, and as soon as he had found a substitute for himself in his aunt's little business, he offered his services to this man for a trifling wage. Here Jude had the opportunity of learning at least the rudiments of free stone-working. Some time later, he went to a church-builder in the same place, and under the architect's direction became handy at restoring the dilapidated masonries of several village churches round about, not forgetting that he was only following up on his handicraft as a prop to lean on while he prepared those greater engines which he flattered himself would be better fitted for him. He yet was interested in his pursuit on its own account. He now had lodgings during the week in the little town, whence he returned to Maygreen Village every Saturday evening, and thus reached and passed his 19th year.
Well, that's it for this program of readings from Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure. Check back with us at the same time next week. We'll read another episode. Meanwhile, thanks from me. Thanks from today's readers. Glad to have you tuning in. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Have a good day.